I'm Teresa Keller, and you're listening to This Conversation. In today's episode, we're going to do something very different. I'm dedicating this episode of This Conversation to the life of Ed Damer. Ed died on March the 21st after a long, courageous battle with esophageal cancer. He was a professor of philosophy at Emory and Henry College for 45 years, but his sphere of influence was much greater. On a national level, his book, Attacking Faulty Reasoning, stands out as a guide to critical thinking. And Ed was known for his demands that you use logic and reasoning before you come to a conclusion. Here are a few comments posted on the site of his obituary online. Matt Long says, "I loved my long talks with him in his office and his politely poking holes in all of my arguments in front of the classroom when I was 20 years old and thought I was the smartest person in the universe. He will be missed and was a huge part of my Emory experience." Michelle Rackley says, "I'm so grateful for his influence on my life. I am positive that the impact he made on countless Emory and Henry students over the years will help make this a better and wiser world." Tim Cloyd says, "Professor Damer was one of the best professors I ever had, and I've had a few. He was an inspiration to me and so many others." Greg Lowe says, "I've thought about Dr. Damer often in recent years and how difficult it must have been for him to observe the cascade of fallacies that have seemed to shower over political exchanges during this time. I am grateful to him for helping me to have the ability to properly classify, let's just say he said, BS, when I encounter it." And on somewhat of a lighter side, Ed Damer was known and associated with the Abingdon Rotary Club. According to Mark Graham, for 44 years, Ed Damer directed the Rotary Frolics in Abingdon that raised thousands of dollars for the community. He performed in 51 shows. He personified Rotary's motto of service above self. He handed off the Frolics to Mark 9 years ago, and Mark says his goal has always been not to mess up what Ed built. And you may have heard Ed Damer on this radio station in his longtime show called Do the Right Thing. You can't separate Ed the philosopher from Ed the person, but we're going to take a little bit deeper look into his life. We'll begin with Ben Letson. Ben Letson was a student of Ed Damer's, went on to join Ed as a PhD in philosophy and a professor of philosophy at Emory and Henry. And Ben was not only a former student, but he was a friend and a colleague and about as close to Ed as anyone was. Ben describes his first experience in Ed's classroom.
It was an ethics course, and it was a transformative experience because I don't know that I had ever been exposed to the idea that there might be seriously divergent ways of thinking about ethics. Took that course and I liked it, and then I took another course and I liked it. And then before I knew it, I had enough for a major. The day I graduated, I was at his house afterwards, and he made a point of saying, I mean, he called me over in what is now, I guess, the Damer house. And he said, "Well, now that you've graduated, I want you to call me Ed."
Ben went on to become Dr. Letson and then applied for a job at Emory and Henry. He's pretty confident that Ed's influence had a lot to do with his getting the position. Needless to say, they became close friends.
Fairly early on, I would go to spend a week at Holden Beach with him and his family. Those were great times, as you might expect. But sort of the main recreation with Ed was to talk about current events from a philosophical perspective. You could not be a better human being than Ed Damer. I mean, they don't make a better human being. Now, that's a hell of a thing to say. I can't imagine how anybody could be any better. In fact, the only way he could have been better is if he could have been the way he was here, but on a global stage or a national stage. He was uniquely talented, as well as being as good morally as it would be possible to be. He was deeply moral, but he was also great fun to be around. It was very enjoyable to be a friend of his.
So to talk about the fun factor, let's turn to Joy Scruggs. Joy is a legendary women's basketball coach from Emory and Henry and was a starter for Pat Summitt at the University of Tennessee. She's in the Rotary Club, and Joy knows a thing or two about fun and laughing. In fact, Joy and a group of friends were part of the circle who had lunch with Ed Damer on a regular basis. Joy dubbed the group the Fun Lunch Table.
Yeah, we ate lunch together. We ended up calling ourselves the Fun Lunch People. We started meeting one day a week, and many times we might have twice as many people sitting around the table as the table would hold. Well, occasionally I could get the topic to turn to sports or get a little aside going. We had this thing about we didn't want table fragmentation. We don't want things fragmented or splintered around the table. Because typically there were so many good conversations going on, you didn't want to miss any of the topics or the discussion. I think that's what I'll remember most about Ed, is watching him laugh and how he kind of chuckled and, you know, shoulders and head moved up and down. And yeah, just such a keen sense of humor. And I mean, not just in our social settings with Ed, but you know, through the Abingdon Rotary Club, where he directed the Rotary Frolics, you know, as the director of a show with not much talent and the idea is to make people laugh. That's a great outlet for someone to show their sense of humor. We had this committee that were, you know, you'd get assigned a skit that you were supposed to write. You know, we'd come up with these ideas and then basically Ed, you know, just reworked them all. So anything that was funny pretty much should be attributed to him. And the things that are in the frolics that aren't suitable, it's people going against what either Ed or now Mark Graham have said, you know, and they get on the stage and do it anyway. And basically, Ed, he had a very keen sense of not just what's funny, but also comedic timing.
Ed's sense of timing likely came in part from his own experience as a performer, and not just in the Rotary Frolics. Ed had a beautiful baritone voice. He sang in choirs, in musicals, and in solo performances. Frolics audiences will remember his solos from years back, and more recently as part of a gospel quartet. I suspect that Ed's voice was on display in a Baptist church or two. In a little-known fact, Ed was an ordained Baptist minister when he came to Emory and Henry College. It is reported that Ed was involved in Methodist church activities during part of his time in Emory. As time went on, Ed held nothing back in his demands for reasoning and evidence to support arguments, even as applied to the teachings we all have had from our childhood homes and churches. Let your conscience be your guide, we're told. The Bible says, we're told. Ed has challenges. What is your conscience? Is it nothing more than what people have told you? What about different interpretations of the Bible among people of the same religious belief? What do you think? Which evidence do you think is the strongest in an argument? And with the growth of this station, WEHC, Ed expanded his lessons on logic and reasoning in his radio show, Do the Right Thing, co-hosted for much of the time with his son, Taylor Stone.
Good afternoon. Welcome to our program called Do the Right Thing, where two philosophers have a conversation about a contemporary ethical issue in a way that may help you to decide what to do or believe. I'm Ed Damer, Emeritus Professor of Philosophy here at Emory and Henry College, and the co-host and producer of this show is Taylor Stone, also a professor of philosophy at the college.
In this clip from one of the radio shows, you'll see just how hard it is to follow Ed's principle of philosophical reasoning, discussion, and argument. He asks what for many seems impossible, the fallibility principle. Admit that you might be wrong.
Well, a part of a book that I wrote several years ago and still is being used. And in the first part of that book, I set forth what I call a code of intellectual conduct for effective discussion. And that has to do with the way you go about doing that discussion. So it's a code, and there are a number of principles that would guide one to engage in conversation in accordance with those kinds of rules or principles. For example, one of the rules, actually the first rule, is if you want to make the strongest argument for your view and to do your part in resolving conflicts that matter to you, then maybe you should employ the fallibility principle in that discussion. And that means to consciously accept the fact that your present view may be wrong. Now, that's an assumption that most of us make in academia. It's the assumption that we make when we go to philosophy conferences or academic conferences or scientific conferences. We read papers that deal with very complex issues, and we want to hear criticisms of those ideas and the way that we have presented them, because we want to have good ideas or ideas that are defensible because they have been looked at by other people and the flaws have been pointed out. If you're skeptical, or if our listeners are skeptical about the positive effect of using that principle, the next time you find yourself in a heated discussion with another person, pause and be the first to confess that you, yourself, may be wrong, to confess your own fallibility, and at least make it clear that you're willing to change your mind. That's what the fallibility principle suggests. And if your participant, the person you're discussing this issue with, refuses to say, I may be wrong, or I'm not willing to change my mind, then you will at least see how futile it might be to continue the conversation. Because why do we have the conversation if we don't want to seek the truth?
Exactly. If the person that you're talking with declares up front, my intent is to make this an ugly discussion by not ceding any ground whatsoever, then that's when you know that you shouldn't go into these waters, because that's how you know that it's going to be problematic later.
Now it's possible that you might not say, no matter what you say, you will never convince me of that. Doesn't actually say that, but acts like that. But if you do say, no, I will not change my mind no matter what evidence you present, then you say, well, let's talk about the weather. Oh, no, we can't talk about that, can we? You know, several years ago, while serving on a panel on the definition of a critical thinker, this is a critical thinking conference I attended, a friend of mine defined a critical thinker as a person who, by force of argument, has changed his or her mind on an important issue at least once during the last year. He went on to say that it's highly unlikely that any person would just happen to be correct on every position held on every important issue. On the contrary, given the great number of issues that divide us and the large number of different positions on each of those issues, it's more likely that a person could turn out to be wrong at least once a year. So if you've never changed your mind, then you have this notion that you cannot be fallible, and you must start the conversation with that confession of fallibility.
Ed's standards, high indeed. Principle number two. The truth-seeking principle. Based on discussions we hear in our general society, this may not sound familiar.
With regard to getting to the truth, it's what we really want. We don't want to hold false ideas. We want to hold ideas that are truths, which leads us to the second principle, which is the truth-seeking principle. And if you're going to be a person who's serious about having civil discussion and getting to the truth, you have to believe that all the parties in the discussion are searching for the truth, or at least the most defensible position on that issue. And therefore, you should be willing to examine all issues, listen carefully to other points of view, look for insights, maybe even some common ground in those positions, look in a way that encourages others to criticize your views. You want them to do that because you want to have a true belief.
And we've gone over this a little bit in this conversation, that we're not trying to win a fight. We're trying to find out which position is true. Now, everybody wants their position to be the true one. But if we have to choose between holding a position and switching to the true position, I think we would prefer to end the conversation holding a true opinion rather than defeating an opponent in a verbal argument.
And we might say real truth seekers do not try to win by ignoring or denying the counter evidence. They win by finding the truth. And that truth-seeking principle has gone hand in hand with the fallibility principle since the time of Socrates. You know what Socrates had to say about that. He taught us that we come to true knowledge only by first recognizing our own ignorance of that knowledge or our lack of knowledge.
The reasoning precision required in Damer's book, Classrooms, his radio show with Taylor Stone, their hypotheticals, all have real-world implications that apply to our most serious social issues. If my church decides to ordain gay people, and I think that's wrong, I have a moral decision whether to withdraw from the church. If my church refuses to ordain gay people, and I think that's wrong, I have the same moral decision. Do I stay with that church? In this clip, Ed and Taylor discuss what to do if you don't like either of the nominees for political office. Is it moral to vote for a third-party candidate?
And, of course, there is always the possibility that if you're unhappy with a candidate that's chosen in your party, or if you're just unhappy with any of the candidates, you can always vote for a third party, who is often a candidate who addresses your concerns, maybe your primary concern or the concern that is the most important to you, but has no chance of winning. So voting for that candidate may make you feel good about maintaining your moral integrity that we've talked about, but you're actually throwing away your vote because it may help elect a candidate whose moral vision is clearly contrary to yours. In that case, the practical result is the same as if you'd voted for that candidate. So we talked about that in the earlier show that we did somewhat and suggested that that would be wrong to throw away your vote and not actually use your vote effectively to deal with the electable candidates, the top two.
And something I just want to note real quick is that I find it interesting that we decided that it's immoral for you to vote for a third party in the general election, but that's exactly what we're suggesting that you do in the primary, that throwing away your vote is permissible when it's in the primary.
Actually, I think there's less at stake there in the primary. The candidates that are the leading candidates, let's say there are several candidates that are leading candidates, and we know that one of those is going to be elected, but we still really do believe that a particular candidate who is not going to win is the better candidate and has the ideas that we think are more important, is deserving of your vote, if you're being honest. But as you mentioned earlier, that vote could have the effect of pushing the candidates that could win toward that position of that candidate that won't win.
And in this philosophical world, it seems that there is no rest. Almost everything has a moral component. Any action that we take has consequences. Are those consequences good, bad, both? How do we weigh those consequences to decide what's right? Is it moral or immoral to smoke? Is it immoral to cut across the grass and not walk on the sidewalk? Is murder wrong? Why or why not? Is it moral to go to a party hosted by someone that you really intensely dislike? What is the morality of removing Confederate flags and statues from public spaces? And yes, Ed Damer always reminded students of the weight of living a moral life, as he did with those at the lunch table and probably at the Rotary Club. He did it with me. I remember at the lunch table one day making a comment about something that was a topic in the news. Ed stunned me when he said, "Teresa, you don't really believe that." At the time, I thought, yes, I do believe that. And now in retrospect, I see what a privileged, insensitive, and immoral comment that I had made. And to this day, I don't want to reveal what the comment really was. And as always, Ed did it in a kind way that made you feel that he respected you no matter what. And we loved him for it. And he leaves a void with his death. On May the 18th at 2 p.m. at the McLaughlin Center of the Arts on Emory and Henry campus, there will be a celebration of Ed's life. He and his wife, Nancy Jean, have asked the Reverend Dr. David St. Clair to facilitate that service. David's history with Ed Damer goes back further than most.
Coming to Emory and Henry in 1970 from the University of Tennessee, transferring after my freshman year, I took a course in logic. And of course, my instructor was Ed Damer. But by the end of the term, I was like, gosh, this is kind of fun. And I like this professor. He's hard. And he was hard. But he's young. He makes you think. He just won't let go. You know, he will take you to the mat. It's got to make sense and it's got to be logical. And this is kind of fun. And for the first time in my life, I'm meeting someone who's saying, as he joked the last conversation that I had with him, who liked to say, you don't really believe that, do you? And by the end of my sophomore year, I was moving in the direction of becoming a philosophy major. And Ed was my advisor. What I eventually wound up with was philosophy, religion, and English interdisciplinary. Ed was my advisor for two years and a term, I guess, at Emory and Henry. You know, I went from never seeing my advisor to being invited to my advisor's home, to dropping into his office, to having him come by the table in the cafeteria, you know, and feeling free to call him at home. I actually even called him at home one time about 10:15 at night because I had just learned something that had upset me. And I called and he said, you know, I've been wondering why you hadn't called earlier. Come on over. And I went over to his house about 10:15 that evening and was there for half an hour or so. The kids were in bed already, but he met me and we visited in his living room. And I left a whole lot less upset than I had been when I got there. You know, this is a great loss for those of us who knew him. And who loved him, who learned from him. When he asked me, he and Nancy Jean asked me if I would conduct the celebration of life. And it was deeply humbling. I sort of think of my role on that day as kind of being the facilitator of getting all those important voices in front of the room. Which will include, of course, comments from his colleagues that he was worked so closely with for decades, and from his friends in the community, and most especially from his children. I'm still not sure that I gave the right answer to Ed, but I would never have given any other answer to a man who gave me so much.
I am one of those who learned from Ed and who loved him. I worked with him for 32 years and remained connected to him and his wife of 46 years, Nancy Jean. I visited with them in the latter stages of Ed's life. I saw him accept his impending death with the peace and courage that you would expect of a great philosopher, but with an attitude that's hard to imagine having yourself. I really feel like Ed hired me. It was a committee, but he's the one who tested me in the interview about how clearly and briefly I could summarize my master's level research. He's the one who let me know that if I got the job, I would get a PhD. As others have indicated, he also always treated me as an equal, and he always seemed interested in what I had to say. I was lucky to be at those lunch table events that Joyce Scruggs called the fun lunch. And those events were often fun and raucous, often intense and serious occasions. But to me, Ed was our Socrates, guiding the conversation and challenging us, making us defend our positions and asking those provocative, penetrating questions. As a local broadcaster before I came to Emory and Henry, I always knew who Ed Damer was. To promote the Frolics, he sang as part of the Rotary Gospel Choir on a talk show that I co-hosted. I saw him on stage in a college play. He was a towering figure at Emory and Henry, and he will remain a towering figure in many, many lives. When I returned from grad school and started my career in this area, I couldn't have imagined that I would become a colleague and personal friend of Ed Damer. What an honor. And an honor to to offer this story of Ed Damer to WEHC listeners.
I'm very keenly aware of the privilege I had in being friends with someone who was that good morally. That influences you, you hope, not just being very close friends, you know, great relationship there, but also a great relationship with someone who is just so deeply good.
You know, I don't know what happens after people die, but I do think, to me, that's at least some feature of what one might call eternal life, is that your influence lives on in this person you touched and their influence on another person and another person who never met you, but you live on. Can't think of someone like Ed in the giant sphere of influence that he had, how much that will continue and ripple into the world.
Ed was the structure. He was what held up what Emory and Henry both was and aspired to be. It's no wonder that he is one of the ones who was the Teacher of the Year in the Commonwealth of Virginia, because he represented the best, not just of what we were, but he represented the best of what his field was, philosophy, and he represented the best of what his calling was, teaching. And I love him.
Ed Damer is survived by his wife, Nancy Jean Bradford, and 4 children and 6 grandchildren. Those who are interested may make a contribution to the T. Edward Damer Rotary Scholarship at Emory and Henry College. A celebration of Ed's life will be held on May the 18th at 2 p.m. at the McLaughlin Center of the Arts on the Emory and Henry campus. Rest in peace, Ed. I'm Teresa Keller. This has been a special episode of This Conversation, airing on Wednesday, April the 3rd at 6, with a replay on Sunday, April the 7th at 2. And it's available, should you want to hear it again or share it, at the podcast site, which you can find by searching WEHC Podcast, This Conversation.